Good morning, cherished listeners. You're listening to GBC URI Radio Bolgatanga. That is, we are also live throughout the country. This morning, we are reaching you from Bolgatanga, and we're privileged to have with us His Excellency, President John Dramani Mahama, the President of the Republic of Ghana, who would, through us, you know, address the nation by way of talking to us through our questions, and would also want to find out, quite apart from national issues, some of the issues that the Upper East region is bedeviled with. And if re-elected to champion the cause of Ghana, what his government would be doing in those areas to see those issues being solved. My name is Osman Muntawakil, and I want to welcome His Excellency. Good morning, sir, and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, good morning, Muntawakil. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
You were in the Upper West region, and whilst in the Upper West region, a Fraframan hosted you. So here today, a Dagati man is doing the hosting. Other than that, he would have taken all the dog heads.
That's right. We had a great interview in Upper West, and I'm looking forward to a great interview here too.
Yeah. Thank you for your time, sir. Somewhere in September, if we just would move on, somewhere in September 2015, you were appointed by the United Nations General Secretary, along with Ms. Erna Solberg, the Norwegian Prime Minister, to co-chair advocacy into the Sustainable Development Goals. In July this year, you launched the Sustainable Development Goals. What has your government been doing about the Sustainable Development Goals, and in particular, which of them is very important to you, and how do you marry that into the manifesto of the NDC?
Thank you very much. It was an honor and privilege to have been appointed as co-chair of the Advocacy Committee on the Sustainable Development Goals. I think it goes as a credit to the whole of Ghana. It's a recognition that we're doing something right, and that is why I received that appointment. I also think it's a reflection of the success we chalked in terms of the implementation of the Millennium Development Goals. Ghana was hugely successful. If you compare us with our peers in Africa, Ghana hit most of the important goals. We achieved almost universal primary enrollment. We achieved gender parity in enrollment. Ghana achieved reduction of poverty and hunger by half long before the target date of 2015. So I think that is a recognition of the work we all did together that led to my appointment as the co-chair. Based on the success of the MDGs, the United Nations decided to set a new global targets, and those global targets became known as the Sustainable Development Goals, because we realized that targeting and working together on achieving those targets was very successful under the MDGs. And so we set ourselves new targets and new goals to be able to achieve in a 15-year time frame. We passed the SDGs in September last year, 2015. The whole world signed on to it. I think that is the most ambitious project the UN has ever undertaken. It looks quite difficult to attain, but I think that working together as the world, we should be able to go as close as possible to attain those targets. In Ghana, I have quickly moved to begin implementation. I inaugurated the implementation committee that is going to supervise overall how we integrate the targets of the Sustainable Development Goals into our budgeting, into our policy making. And so that committee is up and working already, and they're going to be generating annual reports to see what progress we're making in setting targets and trying to reach goals. Monitoring and evaluation is important, so that if you have these annual reports, you can see what the state of attainment of these goals are. So those are the first steps we've taken. We have a 15-year period. And I wouldn't say that any of the goals is the most important. I think that they are all important, you know, because how can you say, you know, some achieving sustainable energy production is better, is a more important goal than, you know, ameliorating issues to do with climate change. We're beginning to feel the effects of climate change here. Look how early the Hamatan has come. Mm-hmm. And aside from that, the last 3 years have been the hottest years since temperatures started being taken in the world. And so it shows that something is, you know, changing in our world. And so we need to adapt to the changing climate and also take steps to limit, you know, continued destruction of the environment. And so I am committed to it because I'm the co-chair, and we're going to, Ghana is going to do its part. And I'm sure that other African countries and the rest of the world are going to do their part. In the run-up to the American elections, there were quite some debates mm-hmm. about climate change. I am happy to know since that President-elect Donald Trump has said that there's a connection between humanity and the climate. That is a good first step. And so I'm sure the agreements that we all have reached, you know, will be upheld mm-hmm. both in the climate change agreements and in the adopted sustainable development goals.
Mm, okay. But talking about the NDC manifesto, are you seeing it a clear-cut direction where you have the SDGs, you know?
We have a whole sector on environment, science and technology that deals with issues of sustainable development goals. But what we have done in our manifesto is to mainstream the SDGs into all sectors. Mm-hmm. And so you find parts of it in putting people first. You find parts of it in building a resilient economy. You find parts of it in strong infrastructure. Yeah. You find parts of it in our governance sector and all that. I think that we should continue to mainstream these goals rather than let them stand out as an isolated segment of any vision that we have.
Okay. Now, let's look at health. Very critical area. You are bringing forth a lot of infrastructure in the area of health. I've seen on television the 400-bed regional hospital in Accra and some other health facilities, you know, and some of the infrastructure in the area of health and other sectors one would describe as legacy, you know, infrastructure. Here in the Upper East region, you visited the Bolgatanga Regional Hospital. Are you very happy about work that is done?
Yeah, I'm quite satisfied with the work done. The contractors have achieved 95% completion. Mm. And they assure me that in the next 2 months, they should be finished with the physical structure. Mm. I think what you are referring to is the equipment. Mm-hmm. The hospital is funded by the Saudi fund.
Okay.
And I sent a delegation to Saudi Arabia to discuss with them the funding for phase two and then also the equipment, procurement of equipment. It's been approved. Mm-hmm. We have received extra funds to finish the hospital completely. What we have done is phase one. There's a phase two that includes the new maternity block. It includes so many other, you know, facilities at the back of the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got the funding for the additional works. It's been approved by cabinet. And so they're going to continue work. But once they finish phase one, we're going to move the departments into the first phase gradually, starting with accident and emergency. And so you'll find that they have a better environment for working. And at the same time, we're beginning the procurement of the equipment so that it becomes the major referral hospital here in the Upper East region. We have a policy that every region must have a well-equipped regional hospital, so that we can ease the pressure on the three teaching hospitals, Tamale, Kumasi, and Kolibu. And that's why we're building these ancillary regional hospitals, because we find that people are referring cases directly from district hospitals to Kumasi or directly from district hospitals to Tamale.
Mm-hmm.
You must have a first referral hospital within the region that is within close proximity of the smaller hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why we're setting up these regional hospitals. I went to Wa, we're doing the Upper West Regional Hospital. There too, they are 90% complete. By March next year, they'll open its doors. And so all these regional hospitals are supposed to be able to mop up and manage cases so that we're able to disperse, you know, the pressure you know, across a series of hospitals rather than just the three teaching hospitals. So once Bulga is finished, the regional hospital is finished and fully functional, you're going to see less referrals to Tamale and to Kumasi, because those have been the two major referral hospitals for the Upper East region. And so far, so good. Work is ongoing. We are building hospitals at different levels. And so regional hospitals are much higher. They are more expensive. They are better equipped because they are major referral hospitals. Then we have district hospitals. Okay. And district hospitals are the next layer. For instance, I commissioned the Dodowa Hospital, very beautiful hospital, and it's opened its doors, it's working. There are other hospitals in many other districts. We're going to complete the Garu Hospital, so that will also handle the catchment area of Pusiga, Binduri, Boko, and all that, Timpani, and all that area.
So there's possibility that the Bulga Tanga municipality itself,
yes,
would have a hospital aside the
we've been given hospital. Land, okay, for a regional hospital. But if you look at the investment we're making in this current hospital, it brings it to the standard of a regional hospital. So what we are thinking of doing is that the land should rather be used to build a smaller municipal hospital. So that it also takes off. Otherwise, everybody is going to, Mbulga is going to be going to the regional hospital. But then if we have a municipal hospital, it will soak up some of the pressure of the regional hospital. The intention was to use this as a municipal hospital and then build a whole new regional hospital. But then once the Saudis agreed to do the full scale of the hospital, it becomes a regional hospital with everything in it. It will produce its own oxygen. It can supply oxygen to all the other hospitals within the region. It's got a mortuary. It's got a huge maternity section. It's got four surgical theaters. It's got a big accident and emergency and trauma center. So once we finish that hospital, it will be the regional hospital. We're not going to build another regional hospital. What we'll do is we'll build a smaller hospital. The land has been given, I think, on the way to Sirigu. Mm-hmm. Yes. So we'll build a smaller municipal hospital there so that it can take part of the pressure of the regional hospital.
Okay. Very good news. I know the people of the Upper East region would have. But now, in even trying to contain preventable diseases and not let them upscale, in the area of cheap compounds, as far as health is concerned, would you say your government have done well here in the Upper East region?
Actually, when it comes to health infrastructure, we've done more in this 4 years than in any other 4 years in the history of this country in terms of providing facilities. And the objective behind providing these facilities is to reduce mortality, increase average life expectancy, let our people live a more healthy life, because they say a healthy nation, a healthy population makes a healthy nation. And so you find that health outcomes for Ghanaians are improving. Utilization of the NHIS card has gone up because there are more facilities that Ghanaians can go to. Even CHIPS compounds we're making to accept NHIS cards. And so you find that more people are registering on the NHIS. Last year we had 29 million visitations on NHIS. We have almost 12 million subscribers on NHIS. It shows you how big the program is growing because there are more facilities for people to utilize the membership. You won't join the NHIS if the nearest facility to you is 40 kilometers away. And then you have to transport yourself 40 kilometers to go and get medical care. It is like the cost of paying. You could have as well just paid for treatment. Mm-hmm. And so that is one of our main focuses. Apart from that, in expanding the infrastructure, we're creating jobs for health professionals. Mm-hmm. With all these hospitals and CHIPS compounds we're building, it creates opportunities for our younger brothers and sisters who are coming out of nursing training colleges, physician assistance training colleges, and all these colleges. It creates opportunities for them. We estimate that we've added at least 6,000 new hospital beds to our hospital stock. And it is estimated that you need about between 2 and 3 nurses per bed. So if you do the calculation, you can see how many new opportunities is created for absorbing, you know, more health professionals. And so that's what we're doing. With regards to CHIPS compounds, it has been recognized as one of the best health interventions in Africa. And actually, the UN is modeling it to be replicated in other African countries, because the chips compounds have become the first point of contact.
Okay.
And they're used to monitor the health status of people within the community. They are an early warning system in case there's an epidemic or an outbreak of something. Mm-hmm. They send their reports consistently to their district directors of health, And that has been seen as a very good model, and the UN and the World Health Organization are looking at it to replicate it in other developing countries. In every chief's compound, we have a health worker who is attending to pregnancies, attending to malaria cases, simple cases. If they see any complicated case, they call the National Ambulance Service, they send an ambulance, pick the patient to a major referral hospital. We estimate that we have built over 1,600 chief compounds across the country, and we're continuing to build more. What we're doing is, it is not only the central government that is building. The central government is building, for instance, in the Upper West region, together with the Japanese government, mm-hmm. we built several chief compounds in many of the communities. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, what we've done is, we have made every district assembly, we have what we call mandatory projects. We made every district assembly to build 2 chips compounds every year. As every year, 2 more chips compounds are being built from the district assembly's common fund, apart from what the Ministry of Health itself is building. And so it speeded up, you know, the rollout of chips compounds.
So in the area of health, you have done satisfactorily well.
I believe so. I think it's for Ghanaians to judge. I mean, Ghanaians can see that they have better facilities than they did in the past. And it tells in this that the human indicators, mm-hmm. maternal mortality is going down, fewer women are dying in childbirth, children are surviving childbirth than before, many children are living beyond their fifth birthday than ever before. Life expectancy generally has increased. Ghana's life expectancy is put over 60 years. Some of our peers in the West African sub-region have life expectancy of 53 years, average life expectancy. It shows that there's a positive outcome taking place in the health sector.
No, okay. So now let's look at it. Only yesterday you commissioned one of the e-blocks here in the Upper East region at Kanjaga. I know the people of the Upper East region might have been elated. It was a concern that since you started commissioning those schools, you never did anyone in Northern Ghana, until you did one in Upper West and you did one again here in the Upper East region. But if you look at the East schools, and in particular, some of the communities that they are located in, there's going to be an issue of transport for the people to move around.
Yeah.
Especially students who might be coming from remotest areas to join in class. I know you are providing buses, but they might not be access routes. So are you thinking of a way where in some of the communities you can have students staying around the campus?
I've actually pronounced on that already. I said our intention eventually is to modernize the schools, provide accommodation so that students who come from far out of the community can be resident on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the government's intention. But in the meantime, I do believe that putting the schools there is important. Mm-hmm. We have put them, and people raised that issue and said, how are the children going to come to school? But the children are coming to school. I mean, many of the schools have taken in students, and they're coming to school every day. We already have community day schools existing. Communities themselves have come together and established their schools that don't have boarding facilities. And when you go, you find that the children are coming to school. Some of them are walking maybe a kilometer, others are coming on bicycles, and they are coming to school. So when we put the new school there, it just cuts over the students from the substandard schools into the new schools. In addition, we provided them with buses. The buses can do a few shuttles every morning and then do a few shuttles in the afternoon after they close, so that they can bring as many of the children to school as possible. But I'm happy that we have been able to open 2 of the schools. Several others are ready, but of course we're in the campaign period and one doesn't have the time. I've told the education service to populate the schools with children, even if I haven't commissioned them.
Yes.
And so this academic year alone, 42 of the new schools have taken in students and are operating. Admissions into SHS have been done with a computer placement, and a computer placement has put children in these schools. By the end of the year, we anticipate that about 70 of those schools will be ready. And so next academic year, they're going to take in more students. With regards to commissioning the schools in the north, we all know that construction is more difficult in the northern part than in the southern part of the country. Quarries where you can get the right chippings are far from the school project, and so contractors have to send, you know, for a long distance to be able to get quarry products, you know, for the foundation. And this is a very complex school. It has a foundation, then it has four floors, and so every floor you have to do concrete flooring. And so it is more difficult. Apart from that, the cost of cement is more expensive. Getting water is a bit more difficult than in the south. And so I can understand that the schools in the north have delayed a bit. But the contractors have done very well. Many of the schools are ready. I was supposed to commission the one in Sapelga, and then several others, you know, have reached the stage for commissioning. But I've told the education service to let the children go in. They should admit children into the schools. And when we have time, we will come and inaugurate them.
Yeah, so your promise of, you know, providing the 43 by the close of the year is going to
No, what I said was 42 are ready and children are in and studying.
Okay.
When we did the computer placement, we posted children to the 42 schools that were ready.
Okay.
By the end of the year, 70 will be ready. We're working on 123.
Right.
By the end of the year, 70 will be ready. Others will be ready into next year. But I promise that, God willing, by the time I finish my second term, all the 200 schools would have been done and would have admitted students, and students would be learning in them.
Yes, technical universities. I hear one educationist, you know, touting you on the conversion of some of the polytechnics into technical universities. Unfortunately, here in our region, our polytechnic has not been converted. Is there a criteria that goes by, you know, the conversion that comes about with
yes.
conversion? And have we met that criteria?
Yeah, we set up a committee, and the committee came up with a recommendation that we cannot do a wholesale conversion of all the polytechnics, because they must meet certain standards in order that the certificates will be valued as, you know, being of the standard of a technical university. And so criteria were set up, and the committee went around all the 10 regional polytechnics to look at infrastructure, to look at faculty. You need to have a library that is of standard, a university standard, and so many other facilities. And so when they did that assessment, they came up with a report for those that were ready for conversion. And so they're going to be converted in batches. But what I did as president was that when we sent the Technical Universities Bill to Parliament, we made a conversion, we made the bill capture all the 10 polytechnics and said that as they meet the criteria, administratively, the Minister of Education will sign and they are automatically converted. So instead of sending those that were ready in one bill and waiting for the others to be ready before sending it, we sent one Technical Universities Bill that has Boga, Wa, Cape Coast, Sunyani, Kofredwa, all of them. And so those that have not been converted yet, as and when they meet the criteria, the minister will sign off and they will begin their technical university programs.
But they will meet this criteria with government support.
Yes. We're going to support them very strongly. Indeed, I would even be happy, you know, if my polytechnic were not converted, because government has committed to improve infrastructure, provide scholarships to faculty to go and study and get their various academic qualifications so that we can strengthen faculty. And I'm going to be a champion of those polytechnics. I'm going to personally ensure that we convert them in the shortest possible time. And so I've spoken to the GET Fund, I've spoken to the Ministry of Education. The committee has given us the criteria where they fall short. And so we're going to take those criteria. We're going to give them more GET Fund support than all the other institutions so that we're able to put in the infrastructure and train the faculty. If they have to employ, we're going to give them more quota for employing qualified staff over the next period, so that they're able to hit the target for conversion as quickly as possible. And I'm going to personally champion that. I'll visit the polytechnics and see what their progress is in terms of the convention.
Why are you so particular about technical universities?
Because we need to make a change in our academic orientation. The current academic orientation we have inherited is from our colonial past. In the colonial past, we needed mainly people to do clerical work, to work in the colonial civil service. And manufacturing was low, agriculture and agribusiness was low, services industry virtually did not exist, ICT was not there, you know, and so many other things, no oil and gas industry. But increasingly, Ghana's economy is changing. We're not requiring graduates only for clerical work and management. We're requiring graduates for technical, professional, and vocational work. And so we have to do a pivot from the purely humanities-based courses and begin to promote technical, vocational, and education training. And so I've said in my manifesto that that is at the core of my job creation program, because the economy is throwing up jobs in new areas where we are not training people for. Everybody wants to do some management course or do some humanities-based courses. But if you look at the economy, there's saturation in some of those places. And so if you take that easy option and do those courses, you'll find that you come out as a graduate, but it's difficult to get work. But then in the meantime, industry, services, manufacturing, agriculture are looking for new skills, and in some cases they can't find them. I give the example of a company, a Ghanaian company, that won a contract from an oil and gas company, one of those who international companies that are producing oil and gas offshore. They won a contract, a big contract, to fabricate pipes for them, and that meant that they had to weld segments of pipes together, and so they needed welders trained to a certain standard. They call it the American standard certification for welders. And so they advertised and said they needed 300 welders, 300, to work day and night to be able to meet their deadline for these pipes. You know how many they got? They got 60. The whole country, only 60.
Only 60.
Only 60 out of 300. And so they had to take some who, when they tested, were not up to the standard and send them for training, crash training, for 4 weeks to bring them up to the standard to be able to weld according to the standard that they wanted. And even then, they couldn't get 300. They eventually got about 100 and something. But then they had to increase the working hours for those they got to be able to meet the deadline. I'm just giving that as an example to show that the requirement of industry and business for skills is changing. Companies are looking for engineers. Companies are looking for technicians, middle-level technicians. They're looking for crane operators. I know one company that had to bring a crane operator, fly him in to operate an overhead crane for a period of time, send him back on holidays until they finish the project.
So you are even looking at an economy where industry becomes the main employer, you know, leaving government to just employ few people.
Government's capacity to employ is very low. Mm-hmm. What most people don't recognize is that all the people on government's payroll, the doctors, nurses, teachers, you know, parliamentarians, the president, my ministers, you know, watchmen, everybody working for government, you know what the total number is? 600,000. 600,000 out of a population of 27 million. And so the biggest employer is the private sector, not the public sector. And so if you go into school with the mind that government will employ me, you understand, your chances of getting employed by government are lower than the private sector. And that is why one of government's principal, you know, essentials in terms of job creation is to create an inducing, a conducive environment so that the private sector can grow and employ more people. And that is exactly what we're doing. You need to stabilize the economy so that private sector can grow. You need to bring down inflation. You need to bring down the deficit. You need to control expenditure. You need to provide incentives for the private sector. You must reduce borrowing so that you don't crowd out the private sector and they cannot get credit. These are all the steps we're doing, and they're showing positively in the actions that we're taking. The private sector is growing. We need to make them informal sector convert to formal, the formal sector more rapidly. And so all those interventions are ongoing so that we can create more jobs. But what happens is we must do better guidance and counseling for our children as they select their courses that they want to do in either tertiary education or in a course, because you need to look at job security after you have graduated,
okay,
so that you can find a course to do. Most people are doing additional courses at the postgraduate level in order that they make themselves more employable. And I always use myself as an example. You know, my first degree was in history, but then after history, I went back to the School of Communication Studies, and I did a postgraduate degree in communications. And so, as I sit here, it is because I improved myself by doing communications, which was a more professional, targeted, you know, course, that I probably am where I am today. When I did history as the first degree, I did it in Legon, and so I didn't have an education degree, because then if I had a Bachelor of Education, I had gone to Cape Coast together with the history. It would have made me a professional teacher, and so I could easily have gotten a job as a professional teacher. But when I finished service and I applied to work, I was taken on because there were not enough teachers, because I didn't have a certificate in education. And so it was after I did communications, you know, that I started to work with the Japan Embassy. I went and worked with Plan International as their sponsorship and grants manager, and then eventually rose up the ladder, became deputy communications minister, became communications minister, and then afterwards vice president,
and now president
yeah.
of the Republic of Ghana.
Yeah.
We are live on URA 89.7 FM with His Excellency President John Dramani Mahama, and we are also live on our sister stations, Unique FM in Accra, 95.7, Volta Sahu, 91.1, Train City Radio Secondary, Accra, 94.7, Radio Central, Cape Coast, 92.5, and Radio Savannah and Tamale, 91.3. So you touched a little about job creation.
Yeah.
There's news out there that your government, if you are re-elected in 2027, and you come into power in 2017, government was going to cut jobs, and that it is part of an arrangement you are having with the IMF. How true is this?
That is absolutely political propaganda. Why would a government cut jobs? Cut jobs where? I don't know. Why would we cut jobs? We have actually fulfilled the IMF program 2 years, all the trigger points we have taken. There's nothing else to do. We're going into the third and final year of the IMF. Why would we in the third and final year, when we're graduating out of the program, be cutting jobs? The time to cut jobs was in the first and second year of the program. What happened was we were supposed to prevent wage overruns. And so what you budget for in wages and salaries, you must keep to. And so what we did was, and I explained this the last time I spoke, was to do what we call a net freeze on the public service. Mm-hmm. That means as many people as are going out are the same number that you are recruiting. So we recruit every year. But then for the public services, if 10,000 people are retiring this year, then what you do is you employ 10,000 people. And so we are not growing the numbers in the public service, but there's no net freeze on health. Health and education were exempted. So health and education, as many as we need to come and teach in our schools or to be professional health workers, we are employing without any freeze. So it doesn't matter how many are going out, it doesn't matter how many are retiring, we are employing what we need, you know, in the sector. And so that was the agreement with the IMF. Why would we in 2017 be cutting jobs? To what purpose? It is absolutely political propaganda. Indeed, we employ more than those who are saying that ever employed in their tenure in office, when they were in office. We employ more people into the public services than they did. From 2010 till now, we have employed 78,000 teachers. This is the biggest employment of teachers in the history of Ghana. 78,000 teachers. If you take a public service that I told you, as I told you, is about 600,000, of which teachers are about 300,000, to have employed 78,000 between 2010 and date is a huge chunk of that teacher population. We've employed from 2013 to date 23,400 teachers, nurses. This is the largest single employment of nurses in a four-year period. And so it's absolutely false for anybody to say that we're going to cut jobs. We're not going to cut jobs. The economy is growing. And as the economy grows, you would even need more hands. We're building more hospitals, and so we need more nurses to man those hospitals. We're building more CHIPS compounds. We need more nurses. We need more physician assistants.
Yeah, building more schools.
We're building more schools. We need more teachers to come and
teach. These are the two areas primarily that are, you know, even getting people employed. But talking about those who may go to school and not do professional, subjects coming out. I want to find out from you,
yes,
what government is doing,
yes,
for those who have completed and may not find jobs,
yeah,
due to the fact that areas of study might not, you know, let industry employ them. What is government going to do about them?
I'll just show you some of the interventions that we're doing. We're reviving the factories that collapsed.
Mm.
For instance, the Kumasi shoe factory. It's working today, it's producing boots for security services, it's producing school sandals. This was a factory that collapsed. Today it is employing about 200 young people, not professional, but they've trained on the job.
Okay.
And you should go and see them working. These are students who have finished SHS, GHS, and have been employed. We have reopened we have built a new Commander Sugar factory. It's going to create direct jobs in the factory of almost 1,000+ people. But then the important thing is the outgrowers, that is the farmers and others who can grow sugarcane and have a ready market to feed the factory. It is estimated that is going to create 7,000 additional jobs. We have built a new shea butter processing plant in Bupe. It is employing people who are not professional, but they're working in the factory. We're going to build two more new shea nut processing plants, one in Upper West Region, one in Upper East Region. Yeah. And those are going to employ, you know, people in the locality. I've asked the Youth Employment Agency to open up employment for 400,000 young people across the country. That is going to create employment for thousands of young people in the Upper East Region and the Upper West Region. We're building a new ceramics plant in Western Region to produce ceramics, you know, to supply the market so that we don't have to go to China and bring floor tiles and wall tiles.
Mm-hmm.
That is going to produce 40 million cubic feet of tiles a year. We have done a feasibility study on the Aboso glass factory, which Kwame Nkrumah set up. As I speak, every single piece of glass in this country is imported, yet we have silica sand to be able to produce the glass. We're sending a gas pipeline to Pristia, and so it makes it possible for them to run a furnace using gas. And that will make our glass cheaper. We can produce glass. Yeah. We can produce louvers and all that. We can produce beer bottles. We're importing beer bottles. You know, so we're taking actual physical measures in terms of creating employment. STC was collapsing. Government has guaranteed 50 new buses for them. That ensures that our drivers continue to have a job to do. They've even now taken stewardesses in the bus to serve small snacks and all that. Those are all employment creating agencies. I just opened the Accra Digital Center a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago. That is creating 12,000 new jobs. I cut the sod for the expansion of Tema Harbor. It's going to expand Tema Harbor 4 times its current size. It's going to create 3,000 new direct jobs, and along the value chain, 45,000 indirect jobs. And so we are taking all the physical measures to ensure that, you know, we're creating job opportunities.
Mm.
We've opened the Savannah Cement Factory in Bupe. It's Ghanaians who are working there, more than 1,000 of them. Last week, I opened a new cement factory in Takrade, which also belongs to Diamond Cement.
Mm.
And it already has provided jobs to 800 young Ghanaians. And so every day we're delivering on job creation. And in the agricultural sector, it's going to be even much better. That's why, in anticipation for it, we are building the Tamale International Airport so that we can create park houses all over the Upper East, Northern and Upper West region, mm-hmm. so that agricultural products, even pepper, is exported to Europe.
Yeah.
If you grow pepper and we have a park house, we can package these chili peppers nicely and export them to Europe, and our farmers will earn an income here. And so in job creation, if you look at the manifestos of all the political parties, NDC's job creation, you know, plan is the most feasible plan if you compare all the political parties. And the good thing about our plan is we're delivering on it already. We're delivering on it already because those things I'm talking about are happening. Currently, you go to Sekendita Kwede, I'm supposed to be there at the end of the month, to commission the new railway line from Sekendi to Kojokro.
Yeah.
That is the beginning of the Western Railway line. And so in the past, when some under some governments, railway lines were uprooted and sold as scrap, we are laying new railways and putting trains on them to run. The first part of the rail line is suburban, and then it continues to Awaso to bring bauxite to the ports, because we're expanding the Takrade ports, and we have invested money to create a new berth, new quay. We've extended the breakwater. And so all these investments are yielding, you know, positive results. Over the last 4 years, we've invested strongly in public works. And you hear in America, the two leading contenders who just did the election in America, both of them said that one of their key economic strategies is to invest in public works. And so Hillary said she was going to invest $240 billion in social and economic infrastructure. We are doing that in Ghana already. America has seen that it is necessary to invest in their crumbling socioeconomic infrastructure. We have started doing that already. In the road sector, we're giving road contracts.
Germany is also going to start
to, in public works.
Yeah.
Because public works, if you invest in social and economic infrastructure, one, you stimulate the economy because it circulates money within the economy. Two, you create jobs. And so we estimate that we've created about 400,000 jobs over the last 4 years by investing in hospitals, in schools, in roadworks, and all the other things that we're doing. In the road sector, we have done a massive, we've invested more than 3 billion Ghana cedis.
Yeah.
And the good thing is that the majority of the contractors working in the road sector today under my administration are Ghanaian. In the past, there were a lot of foreign contractors from Asia and other places. Today, 95% of the contractors working on our roads are Ghanaian contractors. And so what it means is that when we pay them the money, that money is reinvested in our economy.
So if you take the Upper East, for instance,
yeah.
the Upper East region, for instance, and, you know, fitting it in your job creation policies, what specific interventions do you have primarily, you know, that you are adapting for the Upper East region?
Aside from the roadworks that we're doing, and then also the investment in education and health facilities, we are investing also in other sectors, for instance, in agriculture. When we came into office, the tunnel dam was completely non-functional. The canals were silted, and the area that was being cultivated had reduced to less than one-third of what it could do. We have invested in reopening that project. We have opened the canals that were silted. We have desilted them. We've even constructed additional canals. Yesterday, I had the opportunity of visiting Tono, and I was impressed at the magnitude of agricultural activity going on there. Onions, tomatoes, rice, just name it. And it's so green. Everywhere else is dry, and, you know, sometimes forest fire, bushfires have burnt around. But you go to Tono, and it's miles and miles of green agricultural products. That is what I'm calling changing lives and transforming Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things we're doing. I cut the sod for the Tamale Irrigation Project. The Tamale Irrigation Project is going to bring 1,500, when it's fully operational, 1,500 hectares of land under irrigation, so that people in the Boko, Garu, Timpani area can do all year round agriculture, instead of sitting at home for 6 months because of the dry season and working only half the year. These are tangible projects that we are undertaking. in the Upper East region, in other regions, rehabilitating the Bontanga Dam in the northern region to settle more farmers so that they can do all year round agriculture. We're working on the Via Dam in order that we can create more irrigation. And now to the people of Upper West region, we're going to start work on the Kamba Dam to also bring huge lands under irrigation. And I say that I believe in the agribusiness potential of the north of the savannah.
Okay.
And that is why we're investing in the airport. People say Tamale Airport is going to be a white elephant. You wait and see. It's going to start airlifting fruits and vegetables and other cargo, agribusiness cargo to Europe. Because Ghana has a strategic advantage and the north has a strategic advantage. Tamale Airport is 5.5 hours from any European destination. From Accra is six hours plus. So it's even shorter to get into the European markets from Tamale than from Kotoka. And so if the north becomes the agribusiness center of Ghana, we can use the north, you know, to not only feed Ghana and have food security, but to export into the international market and be able to improve the income levels of our people here.
Yes.
And so I have a strategic vision which we're following.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time to see the positive results of these. And so it's easy for somebody to just come and say or can make all kinds of promises and talk about hardship and all that and derail a very carefully fitted program that we're undertaking. And so we're not saying we will do when we come. We are doing already, and the results are tangible for everybody to see.
Yes, you have reactivated the Comenda sugar factory and some other factories you've talked about. Here in the Upper East region as well, we have the meat factory.
Yes.
The tomato, Palgo tomato factory.
Yes.
It's also there. What are you doing about these two factories?
If you read our manifesto, we indicated clearly that we're going to do a feasibility study of all the Nkrumah era industries. You know, Nkrumah established close to 100 industries across the country.
Are you inspired by Nkrumah?
Yes, we're inspired by him. The difference is that he ran a state-owned model. And so our attitude towards state-owned enterprises is a bit, you know, different. I mean, if you work in a state-owned enterprise, you try to give up your best. Some of your colleagues will ask you, is it your father's business? You understand? So it's like, if it belongs to the state, it doesn't belong to anybody. Our model is using the state's financial muscle to be able to achieve some projects, but partner with the private sector to manage and run. So for instance, Comenda, we've advertised, you know, for a private sector company to take, even though it belongs to the state, we're going to lease it to a private sector company to manage and run the Comenda sugar factory. Because if we ask the state to run it, we might not get the outcome that we require. And so if you see the advert in the papers, it has been responded to even by international companies wanting to come and help us. We have Cubans, we have Brazilians who have applied, and they have years of experience in running sugar industries.
But your opponent say it's a failure. Is it because they don't understand?
They don't understand the concepts of the investment we made. There are two strategies you can use when you're making an investment like that. You can start with the outgrower, and then you do the processing plant. Or you can do the processing plant and go to the outgrower. I prefer the processing plant to outgrower model, because we have had bad experiences in the past. If you take the example of soybean, there was a time when government came and asked our farmers to grow soybean. Our farmers were not used to soybean. We don't eat soybean in this country. And so they bought them soybean seeds and said they should grow soybean because we were going to set up a processing plant to process the soybean for export. The processing plant was never delivered. Our farmers were persuaded to grow soybean. They harvested tons and tons of soybean, and there was nobody to buy it because there was no processing plant. And so today, there are some parts of the country, if you go to with soybean and ask them to grow it, they'll say, is this not that bean? They deceived us to plant, and we made such huge losses. And so in this particular case of Comenda, we have done what we call a backward integration. There's forward integration and backward integration. We put in a processing plant, and so the farmers know that the plant is there. If I grow the sugarcane, there's a plant that will buy it. I have a ready market.
Yeah.
And already people are going and procuring lands to go into sugarcane farming we have built the factory.
So I want to find out, you will do that for the Upper East region, considering the meat factory and the tomato?
I was just making that point. Let me just finish with this sugar factory thing.
Yeah.
And so people are acquiring lands to produce sugarcane to feed the sugar factory because they know that the factory exists. And so that is what we call backward integration. Apart from that, the facility is in two parts. One is for the processing mill, one is for the outgrower scheme. We have just approved in Parliament $23 million for sugarcane farming in the Comenda area to feed the factory. And so that money is going to set up a core farm for the factory. It's almost 2,000 hectares. And then it's also going to assist all the small farmers in the area to produce to feed the factory. So that factory is going to be a success. It's going to cut our sugar importation significantly so that the foreign exchange we use to import sugar would be reduced. It will not meet our total national requirement, but at least it will save us some dollars from the sugar that we import. But if you look in our manifesto, and that's what I was going to say, we have indicated in the manifesto that we're going to do a feasibility study on all Nkrumah-era factories, and that those that are viable, we will bring back into operation. Pualugu tomato is viable because we have the Tono irrigation project to be able to produce enough tomatoes to feed Pualugu. In the early attempt to resuscitate Pualugu, the mistake they made was they did not let the factory have its own core farm. When you put a factory like that, it must have a core farm that feeds it a certain minimum of product. And then you can have outgrowers, you buy from the other outgrowers. But you cannot do a factory and say it's a purely outgrower project. The outgrowers will sell their tomatoes to who gives them the highest price. And at the time that the Pualugu factory was open, the market women were offering the farmers a higher price. And so they refused to sell their tomatoes to the factory. And so I'm just giving an example of Pualugu. One of the things that we will do to resuscitate Pualugu, the equipment are there. They are being maintained, and so we can easily restart that factory. But what we'll do is we will get a private sector operator to help us establish a core farm that will produce tomatoes to feed Pualugu, and then they can buy extra from registered outgrowers.
So that will mean a large-scale investment in that sector.
Exactly.
What we did was
we invested in the factory without investing in the backward integration. Yeah. It's the same as I'm telling you, the sugar factory.
Yeah,
we built the sugar factory. And now we're going to invest in the sugarcane production.
Yeah.
And so the factory is going to have a core farm of 2,000 hectares. And then after that, they'll buy from outgrowers. The same thing we can do, model we can use for Pualugu. Pualugu, luckily, the investment has been made in the processing plant. What we need to do is to get a private sector partner to establish a core farm of a certain number of hectares that will produce tomatoes for the factory. And then in addition, buy from outgrowers to be able to meet the demand of the factory.
Yes.
The factory was producing and supplying to a company in Accra, which was then packaging it and exporting it. We can do same here. We also need to finish the packaging plants because we have the processing plant, but they didn't add the packaging plant. And so you just produce bulk tomato, you give to another company and they package. If you don't integrate it properly, then you don't get the full value chain. But if we have a packaging plant that is producing a tomato in sachets, is producing it in plastic bottles and things like that, we'll have the full integration. So we can feed the Ghanaian market and we can even export into other ECOWAS countries because we have the ECOWAS trade and trade liberalization scheme. That shows that if 60% or more of the ingredient of the product is locally produced, you can export it into each other's markets.
Okay. Yes, I can.
But it's not only there.
You have a quest to bring about huge investments in the area of agriculture, and that will require some modernization of agriculture. If you take our land tenure system, for instance, in some particular areas of this country, would you be able to have land for such investors? Because you just talked about a core farmer that could have been, you know, serving the Pualugu tomato factory, for instance. But here you have people who own land in small bits. What are you going to do about them to to release such a such piece of land for, you know, massive production?
Let me just touch on a few things and then I'll answer your question. So apart from the tomato factory, we're also going to look at the meat factory and see how we can, you know, modernize it. The machines there are old. It will mean that we have to install new equipment. We must think about the modern market. So for instance, the meat factory, we were canning corned beef, but then the packaging material became a problem. And so can't we find new packaging material for the corned beef? Aside from that, we can also package the meat products. Hotels are looking for T-bone, they are looking for sirloin steak. If you package it properly, the hotels will buy it. And then apart from that, the meat shops, the groceries are looking for very nicely packaged, you know, meat, so that people can go to the supermarkets and buy. And so our orientation should be to the market. And so now if we resuscitate the meat factory, we will add a packaging plant so that we present the meat in a way that it can be consumed. For instance, take our poultry industry. Nobody wants to go to the market now and buy a live fowl with feathers. You now come home, come and slaughter it, boil water, peel the feathers and all that. But a lot of our poultry farmers are selling birds that are live. Nobody wants to go and buy live birds. And so what we're going to do is we're going to put processing slaughterhouses and processing plants and blast freeze facilities so that they can send their birds there, have them slaughtered, cut into the pieces that people want, package them and send them to the market. So you have to have an eye for the market. And so the meat factory is also one of those we're looking at. Aside from that, like I said, we're already investing in irrigation. And then in other sectors, not even related to irrigation, but to improve the lives of our people, in the manifesto I've said that the kind of stadium we built in Cape Coast, we're going to build in the five other regions that do not have sports stadium. And I understand that a team from Bolga has qualified for the first time, you know, for the GFA League. And so having a first-class sports stadium here is going to be important to develop football and other sports. So that's something we're going to do. We're also looking at the Bolga Airport so that we can commence flights back into the region like we used to have in the past. So these are all some of the other things we're doing.
Yes,
land tenure.
Yes, okay.
I was going to talk about.
No, the land tenure.
Yeah, land tenure is one of the difficulties we have. People own lands or families own lands, and when you're looking for a big tract of land to do a commercial venture, it is often difficult because you have to deal with so many families. I remember when we were working on the Abeime Rice Project, in order to get 3,000 acres of land, we had to deal with more than 1,000 landowners. And so you have to deal with 1,000 landowners to be able to get a stretch of 3,000. That has been one of the banes of agriculture. But what government can do and what we intend to do is that where you have a large-scale commercial project, the Constitution gives government the right to acquire land in the national interest. And so the idea came up of establishing land banks for government to acquire lands and then keep them for investors who want to go into agriculture. But as a social democratic party, I err towards the outgrower model. I don't think that somebody should come and take 50,000 acres of land and displace villages and displace smallholder farmers. You can do a 10,000 acre with minimal displacement and then develop the capacity of the farmers around to be able to produce whatever crop you want to meet the target you want. And so that's exactly the model that we are thinking of and we're using. And so if we want to resuscitate, say, Tono, we need like 1,000 hectares of land, you understand? We will acquire 1,000 hectares of land, but then we'll also register potential farmers around the 1,000 hectares and then also train them to produce the same quality of tomato that we need for the factory. And so while we harvest 1,000 hectares to feed the factory, we'll also buy off all the tomato that they produce.
Yes.
In the north, land tenure is a bit more flexible than in the southern parts, because in the north, the lands were taken by the colonial government in trust for the people. Mm. It's only recently it's been handed over back to the chiefs. And so a lot of the chiefs have control over large expanses of land. And so negotiating with the chiefs, we can get relatively good tracts of land. We are working with the private sector to develop irrigation in a massive way in the north. If you've heard about the Nasia Nabogo project, it is a SADA project. The Nasia Nabogo project is a SADA project to bring 10,000 hectares of land under irrigation in the Nasia Nabogo Valley. It's a big valley that is good for cereal production, rice, maize, you know, sorghum, and all that. We also have the Sicily Coal Pond project that is being worked on with a private investor and the Netherlands government. That is looking at 30,000 hectares of land. It is tied into the Pualugu Dam. Yeah, the Pualugu Dam is a multi-purpose dam to produce electricity, you know, in the northern part of the country from hydro sources, but then also provide water to irrigate 30,000 hectares of land. And so these are all projects that we're working on. Land tenure, I don't think will be a problem because we would use a model of acquiring and also involving the local people so that we're able to improve their incomes. For instance, in the SADA project, the 10,000 hectares, it is going to be, to a large extent, almost 60% smallholder outgrowers and then 40% commercial agriculture and agribusiness. We'll have pack houses, we'll have all kinds of plants there that will process the agricultural products, bring them to the Tamale airport, either for export abroad or we'll send them by truck down to the markets in the south.
Okay. Now, you have, you know, you did cut short for a farmer service center. What is this going to do for farmers here in the region?
Is it
only to provide, you know, mechanical services, or they're also going to give some other farm inputs?
It's going to provide all the service that farmers need, not only mechanical, every support, including training.
Okay.
I'm sure you're old enough, you remember FASCOM?
Yeah.
It's modeled on FASCOM, but this is a public-private partnership. I told you that instead of large state interventions that eventually fail, we're looking at public-private partnerships. The Farmer Service Center, I cut short for the second one yesterday. The first one I cut short for 3 days ago in Gwalu. The second one is in Navrongo at Tono. Now all the farmers in the catchment area of the service center will register as members. Once you're a member, you're entitled to all the services the center provides. Your name will be entered into a database, your social profile will be entered into a database, your land size will be entered into a database, the crop you produce will be entered into a database. So at the beginning of the farming season, everything you need, you have 5-10 acres of land, you need to plow it. Your farmer service center, every farmer service center will have 10 tractors with implements, plows, harrows, trailers, planters, fertilizer, broadcasters, everything a farmer needs, mechanical services will be available. But apart from that, it will have a shed that is divided into two parts, an input shed and an output shed. The input shed will have fertilizers, it will have weedicides, it will have pesticides, it will have improved seedlings, maize, sorghum, all the improved seeds. And so if you're a member of the center at the beginning of the farming season, you go to your center. You need seeds, they'll give it to you. You need fertilizer, they'll give it to you. You need weedicide, they'll give it to you. Everything you need, they'll come and plow your field for you.
So you are even at this point trying to automate, you know, activities of peasant farmers.
Exactly. We're trying to give the farmer the exact support that he needs. And what will happen is, one of the things I'm excited about is that in the dry season when the farmers are not working, they're going to be brought into the service center for training in modern agricultural practice. They'll be shown why if you plant this seed, you'll get less than if you plant this improved seed. They'll be shown that if you put fertilizer in this, you plant the seed and you put fertilizer, you'll get this much more crop than if you don't use fertilizer. They'll be trained in modern agri practices. That's what I'm even excited about. But everything a farmer needs is even going to be a microcredit center. We're looking to partner with one of the banks. They'll have a small banking sector in every farmer service center. So the farmer can come and save his small money there. He can do his withdrawals there. It will be like his local bank. If he needs a loan, he will go to his service center. They know how much he's producing. They know what his crop size is. They know what crop he planted. They know what income he's expecting. So he goes and says, I need 200 cedis. They know that at the end of the farming season, he's going to harvest his crop, and he'll make far more than 200 cedis. And so the local bank there will give him that small loan to either pay his child's school fees or to finance his father's funeral or something. And then at the end of the harvest season, the good part is, when he has sold his crops, then he can go back and pay what he owes the service center. But the service center has an output shed. If the farmer wants to sell his crop, the service center will be a ready market. They have the money to buy his crop, and they have a warehouse to preserve it. If he doesn't want to sell and wants to wait for the right time to get a higher price, there is a shed. He can come and keep his maize there. It will be preserved properly so that it doesn't go bad, so that he's not keeping it at home and weevils will infect it. So it is such a novel idea. It's been done. It's been done in several Asian countries, in India, in Pakistan. It's been done, and it has boosted. That's how come the Green Revolution took off in those areas.
Yes.
We're starting with the first 50. I've cut the sod for 2 so far.
Mm-hmm.
And so construction is going to start. But our intention is to build these all over the country to give support to farmers. But we're starting with the first 50. There'll be several of them in the savannah zone, but there are others in other places in the south, Asuchari, Afife, and other places where I'm going to put these farmer service centers there.
And this calls for very good roads.
Yes.
I'm sure each time they talk about roads, the Boko Bulga Road comes to mind.
Yes.
Here we are having the Bulga Tanga municipality town roads being asphalted.
Yes.
But we equally have very distressing roads. Yesterday you went to Kanjara. I'm sure you attest to the fact that
we're not working on the urban roads at the expense of other roads. We're doing both together.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, it is helping, because what we're doing is every year when it rains, when we had bituminous surface roads, potholes develop all over the towns, and then we have to give contracts to come and fill the potholes and reseal the roads every year. If you see the maintenance budget of the ministry every year, it is humongous. And so they came with a proposal and said, look, Mr. President, every year we spend this money filling potholes and resealing the roads. If we put an asphalt overlay on it, we don't need to fill any potholes for the next 20 years. And so the money we save in maintaining those bituminous roads every year, we can use those monies to build more roads in the rural areas. And so that is what we're doing. When we put asphalt seal on roads, I lived in East Legon before. When we came into office, we started this asphalt overlay. The pilot project was held in East Legon. For the last 8 years, we haven't filled potholes in those roads we asphalted in East Legon. And so the money we would have used to be filling potholes every year, we can now come to Kandiga and do the Kandiga road. And so we're not doing the asphalting at the expense of the rural roads. We're building the rural roads. But let me talk about Bulga Boko Paul Macomb. The contractor is the same contractor who did the Tamale International Airport Phase 1. He's the same contractor who did the Kwame Nkrumah Interchange in Accra. He's the same contractor who is doing the Kasua Interchange. And so he won the contract. And then he is winding down on those projects. So he's beginning to move his equipment onto the Bulga Boko Road. It's a first class in contracting company. I'm sure they'll do a marvelous job on the Bulga Boko Road. When I was coming, I saw some of his equipment, you know, was parked there. And then yesterday, I saw some low loaders bringing some more equipment. He's ready to start. Government has discharged his obligation. We paid him 20% mobilization that he requires to begin. And so there's nothing stopping him from starting. So that road is going to start. It's from Bulga to Boko to Paul Macomb. And I know it's a very important road, because it will generate a lot of economic activity here in the Upper East region. And so that road is done, contract awarded, contractor is mobilizing, mobilization has been paid to him, and we put it on the Enhanced Road Fund. The Enhanced Road Fund is a fund where we put some of the levy from petroleum revenue into that fund. And so that fund always has money. And so as the contractors work, they are being paid. And so once this contractor starts, there's nothing going to stall the project, like we've seen in some other cases.
Yes. Now you have built strong institutions. I want to find out from you, before we come to talk about security and wind up, you've built strong institutions. Under your watch, you've had your own ministers, being taken on by some of those institutions. But I just want to go out and say that if you come on, what will be your overall, plan for the Ghana Broadcasting Corporation, for instance, vis-a-vis the digital migration?
Ghana Broadcasting Corporation is going to enter a very interesting era. We're working on the digital migration project, and my understanding is that work is very far advanced, and we should be able to complete it soon. One is going to result in better picture quality for GBC. Indeed, your for television, your quality is going to be digital, and so instead of the hazy reception we get, we're going to get high quality pictures. There are going to be set-top boxes that you connect to your TV and it picks up the signal. And so we're going to get better quality sound, we're going to get better quality picture. But most of all, it's going to be interactive. And so it will be interactive digital, broadcasting instead of the current analog broadcasting we have. And so we're working to ensure that the migration is successful. But as you know, we are financing the migration from the sale of frequency, because we're doing the migration and then setting up the digital broadcasting. But we need to pay for the cost of the frequency, because the frequency really belongs to the state. Yeah. And so we're doing it in an innovative financing mode, so that it doesn't become an albatross around our neck.
Oh.
With regards to the management, I've tried to explain that constitutionally the management is under the National Media Commission. And so government has a restriction in how it interferes in respect of management. But when I went and did my encounter in GBC, a lot of questions were raised with regards to management and board. Yeah. And so we can only work with the Media Commission to make sure that we make things better, so that you don't continue to have the problems that you have. I'm also going to ask Fair Wages to look into the issues of welfare and remuneration to see what the issues are, so that we can resolve them together. But I think that GBC is the station of the nation. It has the widest reach as the state broadcaster. While a lot of private sector TV and broadcasting companies will not do public broadcasting, GBC does a lot of public broadcasting to educate the people, and that's why it's important that GBC survives and even grows. I believe that going into the digital era, we're going to see a new GBC. And having been a minister of the sector and being a communications person myself, I believe that I will be a champion for GBC and see how we can work together to improve, the quality of your service and also the welfare of our people working in this corporation.
Yes. You must be worried as the commander-in-chief of this country that packets of violence occurring in communities as a result of campaigns and other activities with regards to security. What is it that is in place to that will allay the fears of Ghanaians that we're going to have these elections peacefully?
I think the election is going to be peaceful. I believe that increasingly there is growing a peace industry in this country that benefits from creating panic and fear, so that then, it is used as the basis to sell peace. We've had 6 successful elections. I don't believe that there has been violence that is out of sync with what has happened in any year. There have been, in any election period and any campaign period, there are likely to be a few flashpoints, but as the security services, we must continue to put ourselves in a situation where we prevent those flashpoints from taking place. I condemn any violence that takes place in relation to elections. And I think that all of us as political leaders must make a statement, you know, that shows that we are on the side of peace. I have made it several times. I am for peace. I am a unifier. I am a person who does not support the shedding of any Ghanaian blood for any kind of political power. And I believe that all other, you know, parties should make the same commitment. I noticed that in our opponent's party, there have been very unfortunate incidents. I mean, the acid attack that occurred here in Borga is absolutely unacceptable. I mean, Alhaji Adam was a contractor, and I am a person who gives opportunity to all people. He was a contractor, he was working, he was feeding his family under my administration. Unfortunately, the acid attack took his life away. Today, his wife is a widow. You know, his children have been left fatherless. There was another attack in Kumasi where somebody was stabbed, a young man, and lost his life. These are all unacceptable, you know, practices. No person should die because somebody wants political power. And so I do believe that we all as leaders, our people take their cue from us as leaders. If you project a persona that justifies violence, then your people would exhibit violence. If you project a persona that advocates peace, your people will take a cue from the leadership. And that is what I've consistently done. I've told my people, do as I do and as I say. I'm a unifier. I'm a peaceful person. Don't be provoked. Even on this campaign trail, everywhere I've gone, I said, look, people will try to provoke you. Resist any provocation. Your duty is just to go out and vote. After you vote, you can go take a rest. At 5 o'clock, you can come and witness the counting. You know, and I think that all other political leaders should make the same commitment to peace.
So in the area of we Ghanaians should be rest assured that you're going to make anything, everything possible so that we have this election, because the international community is watching. As we speak now, we have the European Union observers in town. So we don't need to take chances at plunging this country.
Ghana is recognized as a model of democracy, and it fills me with a sense of pride as president of Ghana when I go abroad. And people commend us for what we're doing in Ghana. I don't want us to only be a model of democracy. I want us to also be a model of economic prosperity, and that's what I'm working to achieve. But we have elections coming up, and we must maintain our reputation as a model of democracy and an oasis of peace. Mm-hmm. And so as Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of Ghana and President of the Republic, I'm going to make sure that we create an environment where the security services are on the alert to nip any untoward action in the bud. The first line of security will be at the polling stations. We're going to have security personnel, including the police, the fire service, the prison service, the immigration service. We're going to draw on all their personnel to man the polling stations. We have about 29,500 polling stations, and our total police size is about 30,000. And so it means that if we deployed 1 man a polling station, we will not have any reserve left in event of anything happening. And that's why we're bringing in the prisons and fire service and immigration, so that we can have enough police officers available. We're also bringing in customs, and then the border patrol units, so that in the event of any untoward this thing, we have enough police officers left to be able to manage it. But aside from that, we're bringing in the military too. But the military are not playing a frontline security role.
Okay.
They're just going to be stationed in vantage points, and they'll only be called in if the police cannot manage a particular situation. Then the military would intervene. Otherwise, the primary role for security is going to be that of the police.
Mm. Now, on that note, sir, would want to thank you for the opportunity granted us. But before we finally, you know, take leave of you, you have gone through the country campaigning. What are your chances, your bid for re-election?
Actually, Upper East region is the final region I've touched. It's the 10th region. The rest of what I'm going to do before election day is doing mop-ups. There are a few constituencies in all the regions that I haven't visited yet. So I'm just going to go in, you know, aggressively and, you know, mop them up and then move on. And so that's going to be what I'm going to be doing over the next 10 days or so. Or
so you are not going to come back here?
Of course, every constituency in this region.
Okay.
But I can do a brush up. I can come round and do a brush up. And so what I'm going to do now is brushing up, going to various regions and other places and just brushing up. But I do think that we have a first chance, and I'm confident of victory. We've been approaching this very scientifically. And so we've been doing our own polling and looking at what the numbers are. And we're looking at issues of concern to people in different regions. And so the campaign message is tailored to address the concerns that we find in any particular region. And the response that we have got is very enthusiastic. Wherever I've gone, I've been warmly welcomed. The opinion leaders and the traditional leaders and religious leaders have spoken about, you know, the good things that we have done. But they have also drawn my attention to more challenges. Human, I'm not perfect, I can't do everything at once, but people can see that we've made a good start, you know, in all sectors, in all regions. We're not discriminated against in a region. Every region has gotten its fair share, and we're going to continue to do that. I believe that giving a second term, you know, people will see even far more than they have seen in this first term. But like I said, I'm confident of victory because we've been doing our own scientific polling, and even some of the polling that is being done by independent people. The numbers are looking great, and so I'm confident that we'll be able to achieve a first-round victory.
In the event that there comes a second round, would you seek support from smaller parties?
It's not in my consideration. There's no event that will go into a second round. From what I'm seeing scientifically, plus or minus any margin of error, we will make 50% plus.
On this note, we want to thank you very much for talking to us. You've been listening to His Excellency President John Dramani Mahama from Jura Radio here in Bolgatanga and across all GBC radio FM stations across the country. On behalf of the technical team, who also doubled as my producers, Sadat Dabo and Ahmed Abu, and the regional director who gave us support, Mr. Emmanuel Yani, and head of programs, Harrison Abayeta. My name is Osman Muntawakil. We thank you very much for doing the listening. Good morning.
95.7 Radio with a Difference. Unique FM.